The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Now, you can catch a high-speed train from London to Paris, so why not London to Manchester? Plans for a new high-speed rail network once enjoyed vital cross-party support, but is this being eaten away? Also this week, who's winning on welfare? The government is defeated once more in the courts over its workfare programme, but has it won the argument with the public? And has Russell Brand started a revolution? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnists Anne Perkins and Michael White, and our reporter, Shiv Malik. A welcome to you all. Now, according to its supporters, a new high-speed rail network will cut journey times, boost the economy, increase capacity and bridge the north-south divide and help the environment. A snip at 42 billion quid. But the doubters are growing louder and they're coming from all quarters of the House of Commons and crucially from the Labour front bench. This week, the Transport Secretary took to the airwaves to promise sincerely that the cost would not escalate and the scheme remained value for money. Mike, we're sort of hearing a lot about a possible emerging split between the parties, but isn't the split within the parties just as interesting here?
Yeah, often splits are, by and large. Europe is the prime example, of course, but there are plenty more, and they're always interesting. My feeling is that, and it's only a hunch, that Labour will probably be persuaded to back this. It's important you get all party support, otherwise the markets won't do what's expected of them. Miliband, Ed Miliband, is trying, of course, to say, look, we're not the sort of people who just throw public money at people like Ed Balls did with Sharon Shoesmith. Who said that? We're trying to say value for money. And I think he said this week, we support it, but we also support value for money. So he's trying to say, look, Labour just doesn't back everything. We're trying to be responsible about money. And of course, there are real questions. And the government, the permanent government, Whitehall, has made a terrible bad fist of selling this project so far. All that stuff about time wasted on trains, nobody works, everybody works on trains now, and saving 20 minutes getting to Birmingham, yawn, yawn. It's all about capacity now, and it's all about the regions, and that's a better way to try and sell it.
So could we just pick up on the Tory side of it? I mean, the Labour dilemma there, you know, you've got the Peter Mandelson and Alistair Darling saying, come on, have a bit of fun, like Labour knows about value for money. But on the Tory...
Well, Darling's a good witness. He was Transport Secretary as well as Chancellor, and he lives in Scotland.
So he knows this stuff, but that's the Labour dilemma. On the Tories, there's obviously a few constituencies in Buckinghamshire and so on, it goes through. But is there also just a deep feeling they don't like these big government-organised projects?
Well, there is, and it's a sort of anti-big government thing. It's a sort of British equivalent of the Tea Party, the Sovereign Tea Party. I noticed somebody wittily called the Eurosceptics the other day. And, of course, we do have a horrible record since World War II. Nuclear was a debating point last week. You know, the French and the Chinese are going to build Hinkley Point. Back in 1955, when I was Shiv's age, you know, we opened the first civil nuclear power station. It was on the Tory election posters in 1959. Harold Macmillan, brave future. We made a terrible job of it. We've got the foreigners in. We made a mess of Concorde. We made a mess of we built the first jet. We made a mess of civil aviation as well. We made a mess more recently of NHS IT. I know Obama did the same. So we've kind of screwed it up badly.
But just
it's had a cumulative effect of saying think small, not big.
And just on numbers, though, do you think there's a large, when we got paving motion voted on today, are there a large number of Tories who will abstain or vote against, do you think? Or,
well,
or is it a small minority?
The people whose constituents angry and some of them very badly treated by these proposals in Buckinghamshire, as you say, will vote against. It's a bit like A&E closures in the NHS. It's a free kick and they'll punish you if you don't, unless you're a brave man. So a lot of them will vote against, and ministers do that as well. It's deplorable. And others will just take, you know, abstain, stay away, see how it goes. A bit cowardly and a bit parochial, because people who have to get things done, build the infrastructure of this country, say we're not very good at handing big projects, and that's a criticism of the private sector as well as the public sector. We have our successes, but if you compare us with the authoritarian regime across the channel in Paris, we don't do very well, though we do much better in other things, and that's why they come and live here, not the other way around.
And what's your instinct? Britain's preeminence in the 19th century is said to have been built on rail. Could it be in the 21st?
I still think it's more likely than not, and I think it's quite interesting that Ed Miliband's recruited Andrew Adonis, who was the architect, the original architect of the scheme, to his side, although that may be more of an indication of the tension within Labour, which is beginning to take horribly familiar lines as the leader's office goes head-to-head with the shadow chancellor's office. But I think, I mean, Mike's obviously right that Ed Balls is very anxious to prove Labour's fiscal probity or reliability.
A bit late for that, Ed.
Of course, the trouble with Sharon Shoesmith was not that he threw money at her, but he threw her papers at her when he shouldn't have. I think also, you know, when Alistair Darling says this was just something we dreamt up to make us feel good, it has an absolute shattering effect on the case, on the ability to make the case in favour. I think
certainly makes the last government look a bit of a bunch of jokers, doesn't it? They're all saying we were going to spend $42 billion on something we didn't think was worth it. Now,
well, that was Gordon throwing his weight around.
It was also, you know, it was kind of, you know, a bit of animal spirits, don't you think? It was a kind of, you know, we are prepared to do these big infrastructure projects if that's what it takes to get things moving. But I also think actually this is a really interesting example on a kind of sort of wider horizon of the way I think democracy really struggles. And this is kind of the point that Mike was making as well. We get so focused on the next election and the immediate offer that our politicians really fall down, and we political commentators similarly do, on the very necessary job of actually raising people's horizons and saying, you know, let's take this seriously. Let's really consider this as a national project, one that will support the nation and which will reflect well on the nation, like all France's brilliant high-speed trains and fantastic bridges and viaducts.
Well, in China, aren't they? Where they don't have to worry about the next election.
It is France is a country run on the principle of autocracy tempered by riot. The fact is, in this country, the private sector neglected them in the 20s and the 30s. They were shot to blazes during World War II, overworked, nationalised and undermanaged and underinvested for 50 or 60 years. People rail against privatisation. I didn't like it either, but I knew at the time, said so, that it'll probably look better in 10 or 15 years. It does look much better. The passenger mileage, all that stuff has doubled yet. People still hate it. They hate the railways as much as they hate the utility companies, roughly for the same reason.
Shave, come in.
Mike's right that we have, we're just incredibly terrible at capitalising on our wonderful inventions, and Osborne, one to watch is now graphene. Osborne keeps going on about how, you know, graphene is going to be a big thing.
Every year,
indeed. And we'll probably fail at capitalising on that too. But, Anne's also right. We're terrible in this country. I don't think it's just a problem of democracy. It really is a problem of sort of Anglo-Saxon democracy, if you want, of investing in the future. Our sort of horizons, but also, economically speaking, our time preference is just terrible. We love living it up for now, and we hate, in a sense, saving for the future. This is an attitudinal problem, both with politics and the electorate. So we haven't invested. We've done terribly badly investing in railways. But there's a whole load of other things we've been terrible at investing at, including housing and a housing stock, which all sort of weighs into all of this. But specifically on high-speed rail, I mean, my query is, why does it take an hour to get to Ipswich, 2 hours to get to Norwich, which aren't very far away, but it takes 2 hours to get to Manchester, which is much further away, and that's what we're focusing on. Which seems
nobody lives in Ipswich.
Well,
sorry, Ipswich, but you know what I mean.
Yes, but they could do if we made it faster to get to London,
and
that's why they don't live there.
French provincial trains are rubbish too, and a lot of people's are.
But they're very cheap.
So what do you think, Shiv, though? I mean, because obviously, as Mike's saying, the argument has to be about rebalancing economic geography, and then you keep getting these professors coming and saying, well, in Japan, in France, arguably it sucks things towards the centre as much as pushing them out, because, I don't know, regional offices that were once necessary don't become necessary anymore. Which way do you think it will go? If we got this thing built, we'd be more centred on London or less?
Well, I think it probably, I mean, the way the economy's going, I mean, we've seen some recent figures showing that London's been growing where everyone else hasn't been growing. It's likely to suck things into the capital. However, the counterpoint to that is that housing's so expensive in London that young families are finding it increasingly difficult to actually live in London and survive in London in that respect. So maybe what will happen is they live some, you know, they just commute further. But, you know, the question is then how does that spend, how does their income pan out? Do they spend it in London or do they spend it where they live? And they're taking actually things out of the capital in that sense.
I also think that it's, you know, it's very interesting that there was a revolt last night by Labour backbenchers from the cities that are likely to be affected by the HS2. And they told Mary Crane no uncertain terms that they want, you know, to stop shilly-shallying about and back full on the project because they believe it will be good for their cities. And they're, but we tend to think about it only in a kind of London context. Yeah. I can't think why that is. But if you look at what the plans are and also about the other, actually very extensive investment programme for rail around Britain's other major cities, England's other major cities, I should say, you know, there's an awful lot of money going to go in to connectivity between, I don't know, Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds.
Yeah, but we'll still have to travel. If you want to get from Oxford to Cambridge, you'll have to go from Oxford to London, London to Cambridge.
No, they're fixing and, that. And they're going to fix that. They're going to reopen that line via Bedford, I think it is. Is it Bedford?
Oh, so back to Beeching. Blaming it on him.
Well, there is an idea that you you actually solve the HS2 problem by opening an old killed-off Beeching line. I came up to London from Cornwall, where I grew up, and for a university interview, 62, 63, believe it or not, that cold winter, I opened a paper, and this fellow Beeching was going to shut the train I was travelling on. I remember it vividly. There it was, one of the closed lines, and we can open some of them. And Oxford to Cambridge is one of them. It's very important sort of cluster stuff, get all those brainy fellows working harder together, like they did at Bletchley, which is halfway between the two during the war.
OK, let's leave the trains gliding along the tracks to crash or not there for now and turn to the government's get-tough approach on welfare, which the opinion polls have been saying for some time is popular, but there's been a few practical setbacks. And in particular, the Supreme Court backed an earlier judgment in the so-called Poundland case, saying that the government's workfare schemes were legally flawed. Now, Shiv Malik, you've followed this much more closely than most people. It wasn't a total defeat for the government, was it?
It wasn't a total defeat, so I guess where we were was it was a repeat of the Court of Appeal's opinion, ostensibly.
Well, just remind us what the background was. You know, what was
Kate
complaint?
Riley is a sort of 24-year-old graduate, a geology graduate, and she was made to work on pain of losing her benefits in Poundland for a number of weeks unpaid. Actually, we broke that story back almost 2 years ago to the day. And it was from there that she got in touch with lawyers. They took their case, and the original substance of the case was that actually, on a human rights basis, this was forced labour, and it was therefore unlawful.
Almost slavery, therefore.
It forced labour, slavery. It falls in the same bracket, but the technical was that it was forced labour, which is, yeah. So then, but also as part of that case, what the lawyers argued, and this actually became their strongest argument, but one that the media didn't, in a sense, pick up as much because it's less sexy, really, was that the Secretary of State hadn't provided both Parliament and the people doing this, job seekers, with enough information. Ostensibly, and, you know, in a sense, if information is control, it was unfair for people, both Parliament and people doing this, to not have enough information to understand why they would be made to do it and how, therefore, to appeal later on and go to the courts, which, as you can see, it's a kind of argument that might appeal to judges. And lo and behold, it did. In fact, it appealed to 5 Supreme Court judges enough that they said, yes, all of this is invalid. So the regulations, the laws on which, you know, Secretary of State and DWP made job seekers go and do all of this unpaid work, those laws were struck down.
So they've got to rewrite the rules and they've got to be clearer with people what their obligations are, how long it will go on.
Now, there would have been 2 implications. One, they would have to rewrite the rules. They dealt with that. I'll come back to that in a second. But also that anyone who'd been sanctioned for failing to abide by these rules, which were then unlawful, would have to be rebated. Now, that amounted to about £130 million for 250,000 job seekers or thereabouts. So how did the Secretary of State deal with this? Well, he dealt with this in the spring when he decided with Labour, actually Labour were supportive of this, to introduce retroactive, an emergency retroactive primary piece of legislation, which basically said, let's all go back in a time machine and make it all perfect and ostensibly ignore what the courts are saying.
Right.
Now, the Supreme Court, in right at the end of their judgment, I was sitting there yesterday, they sort of mentioned this as being, I think, you know, they were very sniffy about it all. Basically, it's trammelling on the court's opinions. I mean, if you can't go and seek justice in a court, and if it can only then be overturned, I mean, if it's then overturned by parliamentarians retroactively, then what's the point of going to the courts in the first place? So that battle looms.
There's another twist. Mike, do you think the politicians will care? I mean, they'll clearly go away and rewrite the rules and deal with some more obstacles of the type Shiv's detailing there. In the end, they'll get a modified scheme through, I imagine. Will they be seriously inconvenienced by this or not?
Well, they're always embarrassed and inconvenienced. I mean, Shiv got a grip on this, obviously, but it's OK for judges to say you acted illegally or you're not clear or you'll have to try again. And for Parliament to say, and the government, it's government proposes, Parliament decides, to say, oh, well, we'll change it in that case, retrospectively or otherwise. Retrospective legislation in principle is a bad thing, but occasionally it's necessary. And, you know, it's not the end of the world. It's the system working, a tripartite system, legislature, executive, judges. You thrash it out, and we've seen it across a whole range of civil liberty issues and many others as well. It's a battlefield, and so it should be in an open society. These things are fantastically difficult to get right. I remember a former pensions minister when Ian Duncan Smith got stuck in saying they won't be able to do this universal credit job. When I was the Secretary of State, they just said it was technically too difficult. Well, maybe that's defeatist talk, or maybe it is. We've just seen Obamacare come unstuck across the pond, and as I said a minute ago, NHS IT is not a triumph. This is really difficult what they're trying to do.
I mean, I think it's I think ultimately politicians aren't going to be bothered by this. Labour's move in supporting all this under Liam Byrne has meant that, you know, there's parliamentary sort of cover for all of this. So the political class will stick together, and they have done. I think they've also won the public debate on welfare and this idea of making people work for their benefits. Actually, that's been won. It's been a remarkable move and a shift in both public opinion and politicians' power to be able to make people do this. You know, this was, I think, unheard of even 10 years ago.
The newspapers play to that narrative as well. And it's okay that we want to re-engage people who are stuck or lost. We all get stuck in our lives at different times. Get them back, engage with them at the marketplace rather than rotting. But you've got to be fair, especially to the poorest, especially to families with young children. And they've been very clumsy and very crude. Bedroom tax is only one egregious example.
And do you not think there's a problem here, though, that if people are in a bad mood, they're cross, you know, if you're working and you're feeling cross that you're paying a lot of tax and other people aren't working, but they're also cross with shops like Tesco in particular or Poundland who've popped up in this. They don't like the idea of anyone getting something for nothing, and that's the interesting politics here, isn't it?
Yeah, they don't like the idea that people are being made to work for Tesco or Poundland without being properly paid.
Rather just have them in a chain gang or something.
Well,
like...
It happens in big city firms, it probably happens in newspapers
I do think there's far too much emotive language here. I think universal credit is incredibly difficult. It's been an ambition for 40 or 50 years. And there's a good reason for doing it because, you know, everybody is familiar with the appalling hardship that delayed or wrong payments make. If you can possibly devise a system which reflects your on a week-to-week basis your circumstances accurately, you are actually going to take an awful lot of pain out of the system. And that's why there is cross-party support for it. And it is very difficult. And I don't think it's been particularly well handled. But actually, I think, dare I say it, IDS deserves a certain amount of credit because he has backed off where things aren't working. He has said, I need more time. We laugh at him because his dates are slipping and what was supposed to be going nationwide is actually reduced to sort of three job centres in Manchester. But just give him a little bit of space to try and make what could be a really transformative system work.
I mean, there are at least three different stories on welfare this week. There's the welfare to work and what the rules should be around that, the slowdown in the rollout of universal credit, and also the non-implementation of certain changes on disability living allowance, where I don't know if you remember, Mike, but I'm pretty sure that what happened there is the government just passed enabling legislation that said it would later invent some new rules on benefits to save a certain amount of money without explaining what those were. And now D-Day's arrived and they don't know how to
I mean, obviously they're doing it without nearly enough money. You know, and that's why Osborne and Duncan Smith are continually at loggerheads, because any change is expensive, and this change is particularly expensive. And to try and do it against a background in which you're making just a completely random 20% cut in, for example,
DLA,
you know, DLA yeah. slash the personal independent payment. I mean, it's just crazy.
You can soften the nasty effects on some people. There are always winners and losers. The winners quietly pocket their gains. The losers squeal. You can pocket that if you have money to grease the system. Mm. NHS reforms a decade ago had a lot of new money going in. It made change possible. When you're going the other way, it's much harder. Yet paradoxically, when you're under the cosh, people will be willing to try things out of sheer necessity. I bumped into a cabinet minister the other day, said how it's going. He said, with my budget, I've just got to push on farther because, as Anne says, you know, I've got no choice. It's awful. And so it's an opportunity, as long as it's properly and intelligently and fairly done, to get things done, to do the unthinkable, simply because the economic numbers, deficit going up, all that stuff, economic numbers aren't right, and they're not going to be great for a while, even though we've got growth back. Hurrah, we've got growth back, but it's still bloody hard.
Shiv, last word on this to you.
Yeah, well, interestingly, what we know from some documents I've been able to see is that ministers are going to be making a decision on how to rescue universal credit from the morass that it's currently in, and that decision should be made sometime in the middle of November. So let's
meanwhile, we may well have lost the permanent secretary at the DWP,
Richard Devereux, yes.
Depending on what the Public Accounts Committee finds next week.
So lots more twists in this
Margaret
tale.
Hodge, she's one of those women under the guillotine, isn't she, with knitting needles.
Now, finally this week, having been viewed more than 7 million times on YouTube and fueling numerous columns since breakfast, a segment on Newsnight featuring the comedian Russell Brand and Jeremy Paxman has been dividing opinion on traditional and social media alike. Brand claims to be speaking on behalf of all of those who don't vote and says he's no doubt whatsoever that a revolution is coming. And, of course, Paxo looked less than convinced.
But is it true you don't even vote?
Yeah, no, I don't vote.
Well, how do you have any authority to talk about politics then?
Well, I don't get my authority from this pre-existing paradigm, which is quite narrow and only serves a few people. I look elsewhere for alternatives that might be of service to humanity.
Shiv, you've written a book called Jilted Generation. Have they found their spokesman?
Well, I hope not, because he doesn't have much of a plan. In fact, he is emblematic, really, of Gen Y, if you want, those who are sort of under 35, in that he's so disenchanted, I think many of my generation are, that they don't want to vote. They just want to be completely disengaged. They want to talk a good game about being, perhaps, I mean, Brand dropped in non-violent, but really, I think he meant violent, and just go out and riot. But ultimately, there isn't a plan. There isn't a way forward. And this disenchantment, however, though, is very real. What I would say is that, in fact, there's so much insecurity in that generation, whether it comes to jobs or housing and future prospects, that actually people bed themselves in. It's quite counterintuitive. They don't go out and riot. They keep desperately hold on to what they have until it gets so bad. But I think we're still a long way from that potential point. I mean, no one, I think, sensibly thinks that a vast proportion of that generation are going to sit there starving. So we're not going to have bread riots. But I think they are so insecure that actually they take less risks, they'll do less risky things, they certainly won't go out and protest, and they don't feel that it means anything, and they are disenchanted. So
stay in and bolt your door.
We'll see.
Anne, did you watch the interview that's got however many million clips now?
I watched it afterwards, I mean, it was a good piece of theatre, wasn't it? And Russell Brand's is kind of mesmerising television, because he's just so good looking.
Anne, stop it! If I said that, I'd be
called to order. I heard what you said about Margaret Hodge, and
wasn't innuendos in that sense, Anne.
And but I have to say, anyone who can ditch his wife by text message lacks, in my view, all moral compass. And it's his shtick to pretend not to understand what matters. I think he's much more intelligent than he likes to be understood as.
Well, he's very articulate, isn't he? Mike, do you think that he...
articulation, someone said it sounds like he swallowed a thesaurus. So, you know, on the other hand, perhaps he's not that articulate. He just uses a lot of fancy words all of a sudden. But yeah, you're right.
He keeps going, anyway.
Yes, he does keep going.
Mike, do you think that he's... I mean, is this emblematic of something? The fact it's got so many views, you know, he might not be your type of guy, but he seems to have voiced something or other, doesn't he? He's tapped some kind of nerve.
Well, all sorts of nice young people tell me Russell Brown's an intelligent guy. Give him another chance, Mike. And I do, and I listen to him, and I think, what a turd he is. As it happens, principles of my working life have been not to read The Sun or watch Newsnight. They're both up themselves too far. So I didn't see this interview, but I know what he's like. I've seen him a bit. And try as I may, he strikes me as a teenage narcissist who is doing exactly what he accuses others of doing, exploiting the anguish and the problems which Shiv articulated very well there of young people and making a pile of money out of it without coming up with any answers. Somebody's heard his guest article in the New Statesman, which I'm afraid I do intend to read, but only for the schadenfreude I will enjoy.
It's awfully long, Mike.
6,000 words. Yeah, you knew it'd be long-winded and tedious as well as everything else and the thesaurus. But that it's basically proto-fascist. He's saying, you know, don't vote, riot, let's have a revolution, in which probably he can do a lot of screwing around, because that seems to be one of his more important priorities. And, you know, pass the sick bag, Mum, I'm sorry.
Oh dear, well, he's not here to answer back. We're going to leave it there for now. Russell Brand, if you want to ring in and do a right of reply, then please do. My thanks to Shiv Malik, to Anne Perkins and Michael White. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.